101, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Anna Mateo, Dan Novak, and Jill Robbins. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Anna Mateo.
Early data suggests that people infected with the Omicron coronavirus are 50 to 70% less likely to be hospitalized than those with the Delta. Britain's public health agency announced Thursday, December 23rd. The new findings on COVID-19 disease was a small ray of sunlight, said one researcher. The data adds to growing evidence that Omicron produces milder sickness than other versions of the virus. But scientists warn that reductions in severity must be weighed against the fact that Omicron spreads much faster than Delta. Based on cases in Britain, a person with Omicron is estimated to be 31% to 45% less likely to go to a hospital emergency department compared to someone with Delta. And the same person is 50 to 70% less likely to be admitted to hospital, the agency said. The British Public Health Security Agency said the finding has a high level of uncertainty. It said it was based on a small number of Omicron patients in hospitals, and that most of them were in younger age groups. As of December 20th, 132 people had been admitted to UK hospitals with confirmed Omicron. 14 of them died, all between the ages of 52 and 96. Experts not involved with the research called it promising. To me, it's a small ray of sunlight among all the dark clouds, said Dr. Jonathan Lee, director of the Harvard Brigham Virology Specialty Laboratory. The signs that Omicron may cause less severe disease support lab data suggesting Omicron does not grow as well in cells of the lungs, Lee said. The findings add to similar data from South Africa, added Dr. Bruce Walker. He is director of the Reagan Institute of Massachusetts General Hospital, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and Harvard. Walker said there are still unknowns, such as the relative severity of Omicron in someone vaccinated compared with someone who had COVID-19 before, or someone who is unvaccinated and has not had the disease. Vaccination remains critical, he said. Walker is an investigator with the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, which also supports the Associated Press's Health and Science Department. The British agency's research said the protection a vaccine booster shot gives against symptomatic Omicron infection appears to lessen after about 10 weeks. Protection against hospitalization and severe disease is likely to last longer, it said. The announcement came after two studies from Imperial College London and Scottish researchers found patients with Omicron were 20 to 68% less likely to require hospital treatment than those with Delta. Information from South Africa, where Omicron was discovered, have also suggested Omicron might be less severe there. Salim Abdul Karim is an infectious disease expert in South Africa. He recently said that the rate of admissions to hospitals was far lower for Omicron than it was for Delta. Our overall admission rate is in the region of around 2% to 4% compared to previously, where it was closer to 20%, he said. Karim added that although there are a large number of cases, fewer are being admitted to the hospital. I'm Ana Mateo.
In the United States, debates over issues like reopening, masks, vaccines, and racism played out all over the country in 2021. And it was no different for schools. As vaccines started being distributed to teachers and school officials in January, Americans were hopeful schools could start returning to normal. The pandemic forced many school systems to give up in-person classes in 2020. Many American students were still learning remotely as 2021 began. Research from last year showed how students' learning slowed, largely due to the change to online learning. In the winter and spring, schools slowly started bringing students back in person. And as the new school year began in the autumn, it appeared that schools were ready for a return to full-time in-person classes. But officials, politicians, families, and students could not seem to agree on how to safely return to class. The highly infectious Delta variant of the coronavirus started spreading in the U.S. just before the new school year, and plans quickly changed. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued guidance in August recommending that all students, teachers, and school workers wear masks in schools. But some state lawmakers' policies on masking went against school and public health officials' opinions on what was safe. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis banned schools in the state from requiring masks. He called mask wearing a choice that parents should make and not the government. He also claimed that masks prevented children from learning and communicating.
But some school systems in the state chose not to listen to the governor's order. One was Leon County, where the state capital of Tallahassee is located. Sarah Lee is a mother of two children attending school in Leon County. She said wearing masks did not prevent her kids from learning, as DeSantis has suggested. I was relieved when our school board went against our governor, Lee told VOA. The state of Texas also banned masks. But schools in the cities of Austin and Dallas chose to ignore the ban. As vaccines for children became available in April and May, schools made efforts to get them shots. Public health experts say vaccines are the most effective way to prevent severe illness from COVID-19. But there continues to be plenty of misinformation on the vaccine's safety and effectiveness. And some lawmakers have tried to prevent schools from vaccinating students. In Tennessee, the health department ended vaccination events aimed at children. Republican lawmakers accused the health department of pressuring children to get the vaccine. Children are at lower risk of getting severe COVID-19 infection and being hospitalized. However, the risk remains. They can also still spread the disease to school workers and family members. Like in many areas of the economy, the pandemic has led to teacher and worker shortages in schools. Teachers have been retiring or leaving their jobs at high rates. Many have experienced burnout. Districts have faced shortages before, but many now say it is the worst it has ever been. The National Education Association questioned 2,690 educators in June. 32% said the pandemic drove them to leave teaching earlier than expected. Another survey by the RAND Corporation found that teachers had high levels of stress and were three times more likely than adults in other professions to experience depression. This is the worst shortage of labor we have ever had, said Tony Wold. He is the superintendent of a school system in California's West Contra Costa County. We opened this year with 50 teaching positions open. That means students are going to 50 classrooms that do not have a permanent teacher. There is also a shortage of cleaners, food service workers, and others, Wold said.
Schools, parents, and lawmakers also disagreed over ways to teach about racism and critical race theory, or CRT, in schools. Critical race theory is a way of thinking about America's history through race. It argues that racism is a part of all of America's government and businesses, and more than just individual discrimination. Some ideas related to the theory are being taught in public schools. Tassie Zahner teaches American history in Montgomery County, Maryland. She said it would be very hard to teach her class without using some CRT ideas, like America's history of racism. In order to teach a U.S. history class correctly, you have to talk about those things, she said. You can't prepare students if you're not teaching the truth about U.S. history. Teaching race in schools has become an important cause for conservatives. Many Republican-controlled states have passed legislation restricting how history and race can be taught in public school. The issue of critical race theory helped Virginia Republican Glenn Youngkin win the election for governor. He argued that CRT amounted to a kind of reverse racism that taught white students to feel guilty about the nation's history. Adu is a high school student in Chicago. Her class learned about the New York Times 1619 Project, the well-known and controversial project released in 2019, is about slavery's effects on modern-day America. She told VOA she sees a connection between states trying to control how to teach racism and George Floyd's murder and the nationwide protests for racial equality. They don't want us to know the effects of slavery are still going on, Adu said. When George Floyd was killed, that kind of showed that even though slavery is over, this is the remnant of it.
The quick spread of the Omicron variant of the pandemic threatens schools' ability to stay open. Many school systems around the country changed to fully online classes ahead of the holiday break. New York City has the country's largest school system. On December 20th, one-fifth of the city's students did not attend class, likely out of concern about the virus. New York Governor Kathy Hochul promised to keep schools open. She said last week, "We believe that it's critically important that our children not end up in that same situation they were for so many months, when they were so displaced from their normal environment." I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Dan Novak.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. 1892 was a presidential election year in the United States. In that year, most parts of the American economy were expanding, but one part was not doing well: agriculture. The result was the birth of a new political party. It was called the People's Party. Its members were called populists. Stan Busby and Morris Joyce tell about the populists and how they campaigned against the Republicans and Democrats in the election.
In the late 1880s, a North Carolina farming publication described America's economy this way: "There is something radically wrong in our industrial system. The railroads are making much money, yet agriculture is failing. The banks are doing great business, yet agriculture is failing. Towns and cities grow, yet agriculture is failing. Wages were never so high, yet agriculture is failing." Historians give four major reasons why agriculture was failing in the late 1880s. One was the high cost of transportation. Second was high taxes. Third was falling prices for agricultural products. And fourth was the high cost of borrowing money.
Farmers began to organize, to discuss their problems. They formed local groups called alliances. An alliance member described the result of these discussions: "People began to think who had never thought before. People talked who had never spoken much. Little by little, they began to study their condition. They discussed taxes on income, government ownership of property, the unity of labor, and 1,000 other opposing ideas."
Local alliances formed larger groups. The larger groups included many persons who were not farmers, but who lived and worked in agricultural areas. These included teachers, doctors, repairmen, reporters, and church leaders. In 1889, the major alliances held separate conventions in St. Louis, Missouri. They refused to form one big alliance. They were divided on several important issues.
The chief issue was political. Leaders of the Northern Alliance had decided that agricultural interests could expect little help from either the Republican or Democratic parties. They believed the answer to their problems was a third national political party. Leaders of the Southern Alliance disagreed. They belonged to the Democratic Party. And at that time, Democrats faced little opposition in the South. A new party would weaken their political power. So they wanted to work for change within the existing Democratic Party.
Another issue dividing the Northern and Southern alliances was racial. How would a united alliance deal with black farmers? The Southern Alliance did not permit black members, and it did not want blacks in a united alliance. The Northern Alliance said blacks could join. The two groups could not settle their differences before the state and congressional elections of 1890. So they did not campaign as one party, but they campaigned for one idea: help for America's farmers. Throughout the South and Middle West, they succeeded in electing agricultural candidates as governors, state legislators, senators, and members of the House of Representatives.
Farm leaders everywhere were surprised by their election victories in 1890. They had not expected to win so much so quickly. Leaders of the Northern Alliance decided the time was right to form one party to represent all farmers. They felt sure of success. For now, enough leaders of the Southern Alliance were willing to support the idea. These Southern leaders had succeeded within the Democratic Party, but they quickly learned that they held political power only at the local level. They held almost no power at the national level. So, a few months before the presidential election of 1892, America's agricultural alliances held a joint convention in Omaha, Nebraska. They formed a new party. They called it the People's Party. They called themselves populists.
Delegates to the convention approved a policy statement for the new party. The statement said the national government should own the country's railroads, telegraph, and telephone systems. It said the government, not banks, should supply paper money. And it said no limits should be put on government production of silver money. The populists called for a tax on earnings, fewer working hours for labor, controls on immigration. To help farmers, the populists demanded what they called the sub-treasury plan. Under this plan, farmers could put their crops in government storehouses. Then they could wait to sell the crops until prices rose. While they waited, they could borrow money from the government at low cost. They would pay back the loans when they sold their crops.
The new People's Party also proposed ways to make government more democratic. It said secret ballots should be used in all elections. It said senators should be elected by the people, not chosen by state legislatures. Most Americans considered populist proposals extreme. They felt the proposals were too close to socialism or communism. The populists considered their proposals just. They felt their movement was a struggle for more equal control of the nation. On one side of the struggle were producers. These included farmers, laborers, and small businessmen. They were led by the New People's Party. On the other side were what populists called non-producers. These included wealthy bankers and leaders of industry. They were led by the Republican and Democratic parties. Populists wanted producers to have some of the political power traditionally held by non-producers. They wanted producers to get a fairer share of the nation's increasing wealth.
The People's Party chose James Weaver as its candidate in the presidential election of 1892. Weaver had been an officer in the Union Army during America's Civil War. He had served in the House of Representatives, and he had been the candidate of a minor party in the presidential election of 1880. The Republican Party renominated President Benjamin Harrison, and the Democratic Party nominated former President Grover Cleveland.
The campaign began quietly, but a few months before the election, a labor dispute exploded into an important campaign issue. Several thousand steel workers went on strike at a factory owned by the Carnegie Steel Company in Homestead, Pennsylvania. The steel workers' union called the strike after failing to reach a wage agreement with company officials. After months of growing tension, the head of the company sent 300 private security officers to break up the strike and protect non-union workers. The security officers and many of the strikers carried guns. Shots were fired. 10 men were killed. The governor of Pennsylvania immediately sent state soldiers to the steel factory. After a few more attempts to continue the strike, the union admitted defeat. Its power was crushed. It would be more than 40 years before America's steelworkers were organized again.
A short time later, state soldiers were used to break up a strike by railroad workers in New York, and federal soldiers were used against striking silver miners in Idaho. This use of government troops to end strikes caused many citizens to vote against the ruling Republican Party. They voted for the opposition Democratic or People's Parties instead. In the election of 1892, Republican President Benjamin Harrison was defeated. Democrat Grover Cleveland, who had lost to Harrison 4 years earlier, would be president again. The People's Party candidate, James Weaver, won 1 million popular votes and 22 electoral votes.
Grover Cleveland returned to the White House just as his wife had said he would. But his second administration would be much more difficult than his first. Within 2 months of Cleveland's inauguration, the United States entered into one of the worst economic depressions in its history.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.